Help me welcome our speaker tonight, who is Bill L. from West Milford, New Jersey.
My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Just taking over. Just hold on.
By the way, where's the basket?
I didn't see it.
Right here.
Cool. Thanks. No. I'm a big spender. I'm trying to impress everybody. I'm from West Milford, New Jersey. Today is my 8,037th day sober, which means today, June 3rd, in 1991, I got sober 22 years ago today. Thank you, God, and thank you, AA. So Lena sends her love. She wasn't able to make it. I almost feel like after the meeting's over, we're going to have fireworks or something. This is like a really cool setup. I really appreciate hearing that the group is going to power wash this room in gratitude to give back to the church, because that's what we in AA should be doing. So thank you for being a great example of that. Look at the puppies. So, June 3rd, 1991. Immense gratitude today, immense gratitude. I remember on June 3rd, it was a Monday, or rather a Tuesday. It was, I think it was Memorial Day weekend, the second was Memorial Day, and I had been at a picnic, and my life had gotten to the point where I had no money. My friends wouldn't sell me non-conference-approved substances anymore, and I couldn't think of a way to steal alcohol. So I ended up contacting my I worked for AT&T, and I contacted my employee assistance program guy, and he contacted Clearbrook in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And I remember, you know, I was really reaching out trying to get help. And I remember I was told that it probably would take a while to get a bed, like maybe a week or two. And I remember that they said that a bed was immediately available, and that they wanted me to give them the address so that the next day this guy could come from the rehab to come and pick me up. And although I was trying to get help for myself, I remember being kind of pissed off because I had plans for the weekend. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to get help, but I'm really not sure. You know what I mean? Like, I got plans. You know what I mean? And I really wonder to this day that if maybe those plans that I had for the weekend quite possibly might have taken me out or something, because life interrupted me, and I went to rehab, and I've been sober ever since, so I'm grateful for that. And it wasn't my first rehab. I had tried AA. I went to an outpatient rehab, and for an alcoholic like me, that's kind of a joke. I don't think I passed one piss test, and I don't think there was one day that I wasn't at outpatient rehab thinking about, you know, where in New York City I was going to go that night after the class, you know. They're showing, like, you know, this is your liver, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's this hideous video and all this propaganda, let's call it. And, you know, I'm sort of daydreaming about where am I going in New York City tonight, you know. I was only there to sort of appease my wife and to try to get her back, and I wasn't really serious. And then when the day came to go to Wilkes-Barre, that was the moment of physical surrender from the drugs and the alcohol. To go back a little bit further, I know this is a contradiction of terms, but I remember my first blackout. It was on the weekend of my 18th birthday. One of my friends from school made the mistake of having a party. And I didn't think of this until the past couple years, but I have a feeling that somebody put something in my drink because I didn't party much harder that weekend than I had done before. But for some reason, before I went into the house where the party was, I was already in a blackout. And I don't know still to this day what happened at that party. And then I came out of the blackout about 2 o'clock in the morning, and my head was out a window in a car that was driving down a highway, and there was some guy driving that car, and I didn't know who he was. And what I found out later was it was the guy whose party was, that was his older brother. And for some reason, the friends that had taken me to the party had abandoned me, so I can only imagine how I was behaving. And I had my head out the window, and I was throwing up, and he just kept saying to me over and over and over and over and over again, "Where do you live? Where do you live? Where do you live? Where do you live?" I'm in a blackout, you know. And then finally I figured out where we were, and I told him where I lived, and he brought me there and pretty much threw me out of the car and drove away. I know that something pretty bad must have happened at that party because, first of all, my friends had abandoned me, but also when I went to school on Monday, I got all these really strange looks, you know what I mean? These, like, "you're such an idiot" looks, you know what I mean? The looks that would stay with me for many years. And that was my 18th birthday. I really didn't start drinking until I was 17, and then, you know, 18, I was pretty much alcoholic. And then I drank until I was 30, and then that was when I went to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So I come out of rehab. Now, the interesting thing about rehab was that I experienced a lot of fear in rehab. The first week I was afraid because I really wasn't sure if I was there that I really wanted to get help. And then the second week I was full of fear because I started remembering some of the stuff I had done. And then the third week I was full of fear because I wasn't sure if I had made the most of my time in rehab. And then the fourth week I was going through a lot of fear because I was going to be leaving soon. And then they gave me some suggestions, and then I left after 28 days. Now, these suggestions that they gave me, I didn't take them as suggestions. I took them as these are things that I must do. Because these are what the people did that were successful that came before me. So I didn't look at it as a suggestion. I looked at it as a must. And I did all the things that they asked me to. And some of them were really weird, like, you know, get phone numbers and call people. Like, I had difficulty having conversations with people I knew. Why would I want to call somebody I didn't know? I was basically socially inept, and I didn't know you people. I didn't trust you people. I didn't know what you wanted. I didn't know that you were genuinely interested in helping me. I just thought you were a street person just like I was, a scamming, lying, pathetic, lowlife. And but I did these things because I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back. Everybody I knew was a partier, and now I'm not partying, so I couldn't go back. And I did the things they asked me to do. If they had asked me to take my clothes off and stand in the corner, I might have just done it because I don't know how to stay sober. And I started going to meetings, and I made a terrible mistake the first few years. And there's enough people here tonight that I know that there's some of you here that are making the same terrible mistake. And I want to tell you that it's a really big mistake, and that is that I really thought that alcohol is my problem, so not drinking is the solution, right? That's a logical conclusion, right? I didn't realize that there were psychological, emotional, mental, and spiritual aspects of alcoholism that are left untouched if I don't seek a spiritual solution. I hadn't heard that yet. But after 3.5 years of being in AA and going through the motions and parroting all the stuff that I was hearing, I realized that I was incredibly miserable. 3.5 years. And I started thinking to myself, you know, if this is what it's going to be like, this really sucks. I might as well just kill myself, or I might as well just drink, because at least I have moments of relief when I drink. At least I can escape from this craziness inside of me. Because now I'm not drinking, so I'm feeling it. And it wasn't very nice. I wasn't seeking any kind of a solution. I wasn't growing. I wasn't looking at myself. I was still blaming everybody. I was still acting any way I wanted to. But if you asked me how I was doing, I was fine. People were asking me to work with them. None of them were getting sober, and I can easily see why today, but I didn't know then. I couldn't really help myself. I couldn't really deal with life myself, so what kind of message was I carrying to other people? I was carrying the message of drama management. I was carrying the message of ego babysitting, which is not AA. Sponsorship is not drama management. So after 3.5 years, being completely miserable, being completely crazy, being completely uncomfortable, being completely pissed off and really, really freaking, I went to a meeting where I didn't really know a lot of people. It was a meeting I had never been to before, and a couple of people shared pretty honestly during the meeting, and I took a risk, and I raised my hand, and I said, you know, I'm not doing very well. I'm not sure. I think there's something wrong with me. And after the meeting was over, a couple of people came up to me and said, you know, Bill, it sounds like you need to get into the steps. And I really thought that the steps were, which I still do today, I think the steps are relatively intellectually insulting. I could come up with a much better program than that. And I really didn't think they applied to me, because this is about not drinking, right? So what's all this other stuff all about? I don't need that. That's for hardcore alcoholics, you know what I mean? I don't need that other stuff. You know, I'm just living my life any way I want to. That's how I live my life. And then, you know, maybe a week later or something like that, I went to another meeting and I didn't know too many people there, so I took the risk again and I raised my hand and said, you know, I'm not doing too good, and I shared a couple things about how my life was at the time. And after the meeting was over, a couple of people came up to me and said, you know, Bill, it sounds like you need to get into the steps. And I thought the people from the first meeting told the people from the second meeting to say that to me, because I'm extremely self-centered. I'm sure nobody here can relate to that. And then I took a risk and I said something to my sponsor at the time, and he said, Bill, you know, it sounds like you need to get into the steps. And so we started doing some step work. What that step work was, I still to this day don't really know. The only part of it that I remember was a 3-column resentment inventory, which as I see it today, is completely worthless. And what I mean by that is that the first 3 columns of the resentment inventory don't tell us anything new. We know who we're pissed at, we know why we're pissed at them, and we know how it makes us feel. So where's the transformation? And while I was in the middle of my 4-step, my sponsor sort of, he got involved in Amway. So he wasn't going to a lot of meetings anymore. And he was basically networking his friends into Amway. And it was sort of a big turnoff for me. And anytime he sort of became an evangelical Amway guy, you know what I mean? It's like, and anytime I tried to get together with him to go to a meeting, it would never happen, and we sort of faded apart. And, you know, I'm in the middle of my 4-step, and I don't have anybody working with me, and when you don't have anybody, you know, sort of pushing you to do the step work, then you pretty much just put it down. And I know today that that's one of the biggest nightmares in AA, is to put down step work. Because psychologically, I was like an open wound. Psychologically, I had brought to my consciousness stuff that had been in my unconscious for a really long time. And now not only was I reliving it, but I was starting to redo the things that I used to do in my past, because it all was right in my face, because I was writing inventory. And for a year or two, I suffered greatly, because I didn't continue forward with the steps. And as I see it now, I don't think the step work that I was doing was really transformative anyway. But my sponsor did the best he could. This is what was passed down to him. And after a while of that, I mean, my life was completely intolerable, and that was what brought me to 3.5 years of, you know, if this is what it's going to be like, this sucks, I might as well just, like, leave. I mean, what good is this? I'm not happy. I'm not comfortable. I'm not digging it. Something started happening to me at that time that some people here I can guarantee can relate to this. And what started happening was people with less time than me were doing better than I was. That is the most annoying thing in the world. People coming in behind you doing better than you. It's like, man, what the hell is wrong with me? And I was at the Area 44 convention with my future second ex-wife, let's call her. And she had these two friends, Sammy and Michelle. As a matter of fact, they live in Pennsylvania now. If somebody here knows them, I'd really love to talk to you. They were these biker guys. They were these biker couple. And Sammy, how I describe Sammy is that Sammy looked like the combination between a Hell's Angel and Santa Claus. Now, I understand that seems like a contradiction of terms, but if you saw Sammy, you'd be like, that's exactly what he looks like. He was this big, huge guy with this big beard and this big smile on his face and tattoos all over and basically leather and, you know. And Sammy was, I mean this in the best sense of the term, Sammy was a freak to me. And what I mean by that is that a year earlier, I had 2.5 years, and Sammy had 7 years. And I knew Sammy. Everybody knew Sammy. Everybody avoided Sammy. Everybody stayed the hell away from Sammy. Sammy was an angry, unapproachable, When you looked into him, when you looked into his eyes, he was just this lost soul. He didn't even seem human. He was so pissed off. He was so uncomfortable. He was so foreign to human life. If you were sitting at a meeting and he sat next to you, you would move. If you were about to cross paths with him in the parking lot, you'd veer over. This guy was completely unapproachable and completely pissed off. And let everybody around him know it. And that was what he was like a year before I had this conversation with him. And a year before I had this conversation with him, all of a sudden, the look on his face changed. He was what I describe as the first transformed person that I ever met. Because he went from being pissed and unapproachable to completely soft and completely kind and completely comfortable in his own skin. And he pissed me off because he was somebody I could point to that was doing worse than I was, and now I couldn't anymore, and it pissed me off. And I watched him at meetings. I was just like, what's going on with this guy? Because you see, I came from a really good family. I came from a wonderful family. I came from a loving family. I came from the Brady Bunch, literally, and I don't use that as a joke. My family were, I never once heard either one of my parents curse, ever. They were loving, wonderful people. They represented their religion very well. They were good people. But you see, they were good people their whole life. I never met somebody who was a complete cornered rat that wasn't anymore. And I just watched Sammy because I was just like, what is, like, you know, he must have gotten on some medication or something. You know what I mean? Like, you can't get there from here. You know what I mean? I never knew somebody that was hard and then became soft. I never knew anybody like that. And that was what I watched before my eyes happen to Sammy. And I never really had many conversations with him, but I remember one time he was at a meeting, and during the meeting he started crying. Now, if anybody here has ever hung out with bikers, if anybody here is a biker, bikers don't cry. Either they don't cry or you'll never see them cry. And Sammy was at this meeting and he was crying. And it was really strange because it was almost as if everybody at the meeting were looking at each other like, this guy's going to share, I can guarantee it, you know. And like, you know, a couple people raised their hands and it's going around. And like, you know, three people had their hands up and Sammy puts his hand up And the other three people just put their hand down because everybody was like, I want to hear this guy share. He's like, he's sitting there and he's crying. He's like falling apart. He needs to share, you know. And the guy picked him and he started sharing something that absolutely blew my mind. He shared at that meeting. It was toward the end of the meeting, and he's sitting there and he's crying, and he said, you know, he says, you know, something happened to me a year ago, and I'm really grateful to AA. And he said, because you see, up until a year ago, my daughter wanted nothing to do with me. She wouldn't talk to me. She wouldn't be in the room with me. She wanted nothing to do with me. She hated me. And she said, he said that a year ago, something happened to me and my whole life changed. And today my daughter called me and said that she wants to come and live with me. And I can't believe it. And I was just like, whoa, you know. Watch this guy transform right before my eyes. And, you know, later that year, I was at the Area 44 convention, and my future second ex-wife and I were at the convention, and she was good friends with Sammy and Michelle. And she had to talk to Michelle about something privately, and so Sammy and Michelle came over. Lisa and Michelle went off to the side, and I'm standing there with the dude. You know what I mean? I'm standing there with the first transformed person I've ever seen. And I started having a little bit of a conversation with him. And he had become just completely soft. He had become completely approachable. He had become completely beautiful. And so the ladies didn't come back right away. And I sort of opened myself up to him. I wouldn't call it a mini fifth step, but it was sort of like that. I shared some stuff that was going on with me that wasn't very nice. And after a few minutes of me sharing with him some of the stuff in my life that I was currently doing and I was currently experiencing in my life, at one point Sammy sort of smiled, and at one point he sort of chuckled. And then after I said one thing that was especially evil, he laughed. And I straightened up and I stopped and I said, Sammy, I don't appreciate you laughing at me. This is really difficult for me. And I don't see what's so funny. And Sammy did something to me in that moment that I now know is very 12-step, but at the time I didn't know that. What he did was very big book, but at the time I wasn't into the big book. And he straightened out and he looked me straight in the eye and he said, Bill, you know, I know it doesn't look like it, and I know it doesn't feel like it, but I'm telling you right now, you're in a really wonderful place. And I was like, Sam, I just shared some stuff with you. That's the tip of the iceberg. I got some crazy stuff going on in my life. How could you possibly say that I'm in a really wonderful place? You're not listening to me. And he said, no, Bill, I'm telling you, you're in a really wonderful place. And I'm like, how is that possible, Sam? And he said, you're in a really wonderful place because you only have two options. You can either go on living the way you're living, and I'm telling you right now, it's only going to get worse. But your other option is that you can consider another way besides your own. And I stopped and I looked at Sammy and I said, there is no other way besides my own. What does that mean? And we had a little bit of a conversation, and I said to him, Sam, I knew what you were like a year and more ago, and you were scaring the heck out of me. And a year ago, something happened to you, and now you're different. And what happened to you? And he said to me, Bill, I went to this big book study that was led by the late, great Howard G. from North Jersey, a man that completely transformed North Jersey AA. And he said that he went to this study that they're doing on a weekend. It was sort of similar to Joe and Charlie weekend. And he said that he was hearing stuff that he had never heard before, and he had been in AA for 7 years. And he started seeing that his problem is not alcohol. He started seeing that actually his solution is alcohol. And he started seeing why working the steps were important, and he started having a much clearer picture of what his problem was as an alcoholic. And he began to work the steps, And within a year, every area of his life had changed for the better. And coincidentally, in a few weeks, there was going to be another big book study with Howard G. And coincidentally, Sammy had a flyer for it. And we had a little bit more of a conversation, and then the ladies came back, and then we went our separate ways. And I remember having a conversation with Lisa about what had just happened, and I told her that I wanted to go to this big book study, and she decided she would go also. And she had 10 years in AA and had gone back out, and I had 3.5 years in AA, and I was completely miserable. And we went to this big book study, and Friday night they talked about a little bit of the history. They talked about how the big book is sort of organized. They talked about the preface, the forewords, the doctor's opinion, and Bill's story. And I heard stuff that I had never heard before. And we lived like maybe 15 minutes from where the study was. So as we were driving home, I was uncharacteristically quiet. Because I'm a talker. And finally, Lisa looked over and said, what are you thinking about? And I looked at her with an angry voice and I said, I am so pissed off. Why did AA keep this from me? This is so important. I never heard any of this stuff. I've been in AA for 3.5 years. Why is this news to me? And Lisa says to me, you know, I'm really pissed off too. I've been in AA for 10 years and I've never heard this. And we continued with the weekend and it smashed us in the face. And that was in October, and I had asked Howard to work with me, and I was sort of balking a little bit because I still was making the assumption that alcohol is my problem, so not drinking is my solution, even though I had a bunch of information. I wasn't really applying it. And Lisa was going to a Matt Taber retreat in January with Michelle. And Michelle told her that you have to have your four-step finished by the time we go to the Matt Taber retreat, because Saturday all day you're going to do your fifth step with me. And so Lisa got it together and finished her fourth step and went on this retreat and did her fifth step. And then did the hour after the fifth step, and then also did six and seven. And Sunday morning when she came home from the retreat, the whole look on her face was different. Now I'm staring in the face of the second transformed person I've ever met. And that really motivated me. And, you know, later in January, that was like, I think the weekend after like New Year's, it was real early January. And real quickly, I pressed forward and finished my fourth step, and Howard listened to my fifth step, and it took the whole day. It's really interesting in doing the first fourth step, because I believe in reworking the steps, in that it's interesting sort of getting a snapshot of how the mind works. Because, you know, we live with our minds all day, every day, for years, for our whole life. And somehow the mind is just able to run the show without us really realizing that that's what's going on. The mind is an interesting thing. It gets us to do stuff that we know we shouldn't be doing and then beats us up for doing it. Like, why am I listening to this thing? The mind creates a problem that doesn't exist. And then says, you know, seek me out for a solution for this problem that doesn't exist. This is some crazy lunatic kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But one of the things I love about AA is I can talk about this because you guys can really relate to it. Because we all have a mind that was basically destroying us. But we hardly even notice, you know what I mean? People go their whole lives and don't even notice that this thing up here called the mind has created every problem that we've ever had. It's never what they do that's the problem. It's always what we tell ourselves about what they do that's the problem. And I had never seen that before, but I started getting a heavy dose of, oh my God, my mind is a completely unreliable inner resource. And it's cool for work. It's cool for driving a car. It's cool for learning something. It's cool for whatever. But as a tool for happiness, it is completely limited. And I would even suggest contrary to happy, joyous, and free living. And I started learning that. And I started seeing that. And I was really shocked before, during, and after my fourth and fifth step, because I never realized how many people I was pissed at, otherwise known as everybody. I never realized how much fear I had because, you know, you can only kind of have one thing running through your system at a time. And then the beauty of the fourth step is that you write all this stuff down and it's just like, you know, like, wow, I'm pissed at everybody, man. I'm afraid to go out and I'm afraid not to go out. I'm afraid when I'm at a meeting, when I raise my hand, I'm afraid I'm going to get picked and I'm afraid if I don't get picked. Like my mind constantly puts me into a lose-lose situation. And I hardly ever noticed. And after the fifth step was over at Howard's place in Gillette, New York, New Jersey, we did the hour afterwards. He went up to his bedroom and I remained in the living room. We did the hour. And I thank God for the experience. I prayed and meditated to see if there was anything more. I looked at the first five steps to see if it was as complete as possible. And after the hour, Howard came back down and he said, you know, is there anything more you need to add to your fourth and fifth step? And I said, no. And he said to me, was there anything that was on your fourth step that you withheld? And I said, no. Two important questions to ask. And then we went through the material and the directions that he gave me for six and seven. And then we were finished. And I sat there in his living room for a while and I was completely quiet. And it was getting dark, and it had gotten dark. And Howard finally turned to me, and he said, are you going to leave? Because it was a while after we had finished, and I was just sitting there. And I kept saying to myself over and over again, what is that? What is that? And finally I said to him, Howard, I'm experiencing something right now that I don't know what it is. And he said, why don't you describe it? And I did, and I don't remember what I said. And he said to me, you know what you're experiencing? And I said, what? And he said, you're experiencing peace. And I don't remember ever having peace in my adult life and well before even. And it was so weird. It was so foreign to me. It was so unbelievable that anybody could just have peace, because I was nowhere near that my whole entire life, and it was a beautiful experience. And then during the next week, in moving toward 8 and 9 and making amends and having also, you know, after the fifth step on the same day, done 6 and 7, I started during that week seeing my defects coming up in my behavior, and it really disgusted me. What I saw was an analogy that I use whenever I work with people and whenever I hear that somebody just finished their fifth step. And that analogy is that there's sort of like this closet called Bill's life. And during the fourth and fifth step, we open up that closet and take all the stuff out. And then we pick it apart. And we have to choose, what are we going to put back into this closet called Bill's life? Are we going to put back all the stuff that just made up that whole mess that I just shared in my fourth and fifth step? Or am I going to let God choose other things for me? Perhaps the opposite of those things that we had just taken out of the closet. The hideousness of my life run on my will, harming everybody everywhere I go, incapable of loving, incapable of being good, incapable of being honest, incapable of being a reasonable human being. And I started seeing these things, and I was like, I don't want to live this way anymore. And I made some good decisions at that time to try to fight as hard as I could not to put certain things back in that closet, because I knew it would not serve me anymore. And I started going around and making amends, and it's kind of interesting because when I was still living in White Plains, New York with my family, my parents were heavily involved in our church. And for a period of time, the church bought this property in White Plains, New York. The church was originally from Yonkers, and they bought this property. It's 7 acres in White Plains, New York, and they needed a family to live on it for it ended up being 6 years. And they built a chapel and a church, and they needed a family to sort of take care of everything there. And my father volunteered, and our family was allowed to live on this church property basically for free. But we had to, you know, cut the lawn and trim the hedges and clean the linens and vacuum the rugs and get things ready for when they had Mass on Sundays. And then after the pastor moved in, we moved a block away and still were, you know, sort of caretakers of everything, and we had keys and stuff like that. And every Sunday morning, not every Sunday morning, but many Sunday mornings, I would, they had two different masses, and my parents usually went to one, and I would avoid that one and go to the other one. And while my parents were at Mass, at the one that they were at, I would steal the key to the rectory, and I would go into the rectory, and I would steal money. So I was stealing from God directly. And when I started to make my amends, I was like, this one I got to make. I got to, you know, I cannot avoid this one. I got to make this one soon, and I got to make it now. I mean, you know, talk about bad karma. You know, I'm like stealing from God directly. You know what I mean? To the point where the church realized that somebody was stealing something. And the police were called in, and nobody ever found out who was doing it. I was always a really good thief. And like I said, it was like late January, that I did my fifth step. And then I think it was maybe March that was Easter. And I was living in New Jersey, so, you know, for the major holidays, I would go up to New York to be with my family, and I went up to Easter that year, and I talked to my sponsor because I wanted to make amends to my entire family one-on-one, and I also wanted to, that year I had gotten a really big income tax return refund, and I talked to my future second ex-wife and said, you know, I know that this money isn't just mine, that it's ours, but I really have to do this. I can no longer live with myself. And I probably stole about $1,500. And so I withdrew $1,800, which is $1,500 plus interest. And we went up to see my family. And one-on-one, I started making amends to everybody. And word started getting around about what I was doing that weekend, because everybody was talking with everybody, and it was a really, really beautiful experience. And Friday night after the service, the Good Friday Easter service, I went to the priest and I said, Father, I need to talk to you this weekend. So if you have some time, I really need to see you. And he said, well, Bill, I'm not going to be doing anything Saturday after dinner time, so why don't you come over? So I said, not a problem. I'm totally available. And we had dinner Saturday night at my parents' house, and I was going to walk over to talk to the priest. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, Lisa and I were kind of going through the steps together, and we sort of had this little community of people that were going through the steps together. And, you know, we started a home group, and we had this little community of big book enthusiasts that went around annoying everybody. And Just before I left to go over to see the pastor, Lisa said to me, Bill, you know, do you mind if I come with you? Because I'm making amends too, and I know that this one's sort of a difficult one for you, and I would really like to see how you handle it. So I said, yeah, not a problem. You know, come on, let's skip over to the church. And so we went over to the church, and we went in, and it was actually a priest who was new. I didn't know him personally. It was just a priest that was there for many years that I knew. He left, and this one had only been there for a few months, and so he didn't know me, and I didn't know him. And he was sort of a little nervous and not the most social person, just like I wasn't. And, like, you know, within like 2 minutes, he was like, you know, so Bill, you know, what did you want to talk to me about? And I said, Father, can we just like talk for a few minutes? I can't just like jump in right now. I'm a little uncomfortable and it's a little bit risky. And, you know, let's just talk for 5 minutes before I kind of get into it. And, you know, we just talked and whatever. And what I found out was that he thought that I was going to ask him if he would marry us. And that was not the reason why I was there. And finally, I said to him, Father, I had a really bad drug and alcohol problem. And part of the 12-step program is I have to make amends for harms done. And I know that this is risky, and I don't want it to reflect at all on my family, who is a very trusted group of people at this church. But I'm sorry to have to tell you that I stole a large amount of money from this church many years ago. And I'm here to give the money back. And he said something to me that was unexpected and that at first I really liked. And he said to me, Bill, you know, we just sold half of the property, so we just got a large amount of money and we don't need your donation. And inside of me, I went, yes. And these words came out of my mouth that still horrify me today. I don't know where they came from, but I said, Father, I have to give you this money. This isn't about whether you need it or not. This is about that I need to give you this money. I need to set right this wrong. I need to save my life. And we talked for a little while, and it was really interesting because he said to me, Bill, you know, I know some people in AA, and why is it that I've never heard of this? And I said, Father, I was in AA for 3.5 years, and I didn't really hear much about it either. And I was pretty pissed off that I started hearing about this, and why is this news to me? And I said before that, you know, after that big book study on Friday, I said to Lisa that I was really pissed off because why did you people keep this from me? But I learned pretty quickly after that that the people in AA in the area where I was getting sober didn't keep this from me. They didn't know about it either. And for me, that's really sad. That the 12-step program is like the best-kept secret in AA. One of the things that I like saying from the podium is that can you really call yourself a member of a 12-step fellowship if you've never done the 12 steps? See, this is the keen alcoholic mind at work right there. You know what I mean? We have this program. We have this transformative, unbelievable program, and then we reduce it to nothing. That's what the mind can do. It's scary, really. And we talked for a little while longer, and I gave him the $1,800, and he thanked me, and we left. And about a month later, I got this letter in the mail. I guess he had asked my parents for my address because I didn't give it to him. And he mailed me this envelope, and in the envelope was a letter. And in the letter, he let me know what he ended up doing with the $1,800, that one-third of it he gave to a nunnery, one-third of it he gave to, you know, like a homeless shelter, and the other one-third, I don't remember where he put it. But I had that letter for a long time. That was a really important letter to me. Because I had stolen from God. And I was really grateful that he gave me that because it was sort of like physical evidence of my growing and my proceeding and progressing in this thing called life, and this maturing, transformative program that I had gotten involved in and really loved, and saw hundreds of people just change because of it. And I didn't make all of my amends, but I made most of them at that time. That first time that I went through the steps, I would use the phrase soft sell. That the third step was sort of soft sold to me. Steps 6 and 7 were sort of soft sold to me, and steps 10 and 11 were sort of soft sold to me. And what I mean by that is that the depth of those steps hadn't been the experience that I had. That what was described to me about step 3 is just a decision to go on with the rest of the program, and I would like to suggest today that it's a whole lot more than that. And 6 and 7 was sort of vague, so I didn't really do very much with that, and I would suggest that there's a whole lot more there. And 10 and 11, I dabbled in it, but I certainly didn't launch like the program says we should be doing. I certainly didn't rigorously anything. And the process of the steps really changed my life. But after maybe 5 or 6 years, I really plateaued, where I had reached a point where I knew that I'm not going to be able to go any further. The work I did and how I was working it on a daily basis would only take me so far. And although the plateau that first time through the steps, although that plateau was a really wonderful place, I started feeling like, is this all there is? It was a limited experience with the steps. And then I started doing presenting workshops, and I was presenting in front of a group in Burnsville, New Jersey, and I was suggesting that we should all work the steps together as a group. And I was saying that that's what they should do, but I wasn't planning on doing it. And I started seeing the hypocrisy of that, because we as alcoholics don't like hypocrites. And I also started to see the plateau, although it was a wonderful plateau, that I needed something more. And the only thing that had ever catapulted me beyond where I was the 12 steps. And it was at that time that I started first hearing about reworking the steps. I had never really heard about that before. Prior to that, what I had heard was, you just do 1 through 9 once and then live in 10, 11, and 12. And I was seeing that wasn't working for me. Because the book does say that no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. And I've worked with lots of people since then that thought that they could just do the first 9 steps once and then live it in 10, 11, and 12. They were falling short, just like I was. I think it's sort of a human thing. I think our ego rebuilds itself. I think inevitably the alcoholic human nature begins to cut corners. And just as I had presented the 4th step at that workshop, I said, this is not right. Hey, gentlemen, can you get off your phones, please? Thank you. And I began to rework the steps. And not just go back to 4 and rework the steps, but to go back to 1 and have a deeper experience with 1. And I had a spiritual awakening when I went through the first time, and I didn't have the awakening at the beginning of the process, but by the end I did. And then in going back through the steps, I was able to take that awakening and have a deeper experience and really focus a whole lot more and drill down on 2 and 3, which was definitely lacking. And I was able to drill down on 6 and 7, which was sort of lacking. And when I got to the end of the process, I really exploded into 10 and 11, and it was an unbelievable experience. And I saw the importance of reworking the steps. Not just reworking the steps, but doing it in a deeper way, which is, we have to find somebody that can help us with that. Not everybody can do that. And I started going to meditation workshops, and I started reading profound books. And I started, in a much more profound way, living the life, living the life. It's, like I said earlier, like the best kept secret in AA. The happy, the joyous, and the free. No matter what our present circumstances, we can be happy and joyous and free during the process of losing our job. We can be happy, joyous, and free during the process of the breakup of a relationship. We can be happy, joyous, and free during a health issue. We can access something within us that is beyond being touched by this human world. But we don't hear it talked about a lot. And for me, this is the secret. This is the beauty of AA. There is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And it's not the concept of a religious thing that I had previously of the God that's up there, over there, out there. It's not like that at all. It's a God that's always and already here. It's a higher power that cannot be escaped from. The things that come and go in my life, not as important as trying to stay connected to that thing within us, trying to be of service to others, trying to love when I don't want to, trying to be honest when it would be so easy to not be honest. The single most read piece of literature in AA is the beginning part of How It Works. And in the first paragraph of the single most read piece of literature in AA, How It Works, it talks about honesty 3 times. Ask yourselves if you're living your life that way. And if you are, welcome to AA. And if you're not, it's time to grow up. I can't tell you some of the moments that I've had here in AA that were just so beautiful, but one of them was, I remember complaining to a few people in my network at the time about how my childhood really sucked. And I've worked with over 1,000 people, and I've listened to over 500 fifth steps, and I'm here to tell you that my childhood did not suck. My childhood was exemplary. My child was unbelievable compared to so many people that I've heard share their stories with me. And I remember one of the guys took me on the side and said, Bill, you know, it's not that your childhood sucked. It's that your childhood has lasted too long and now it's time to grow up. I didn't talk to that guy for months after he said that to me. And then I walked up to him and I said, thank you. I hated you for that, but that's what the truth does. It pisses you off first. And we don't like it because we don't want to grow up. But if we don't, it's just suffering. If we don't, it's just uncomfortable. If we don't, it's just lame. And that's not how life is meant to be. And when life is lame, then drinking is an option because drinking helps us with that. And that's what I meant earlier about alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol is my solution to that inner craziness. And I don't understand why it works that way. I just know it does. I want to close with these 2 paragraphs out of the big book. I heard about a meeting once that does this. This is how they close their meetings. A person gets up at the end and they say the following. This is what it looks like and what it feels like when we're living in the problem. In other words, when we're spiritually blocked. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uneasiness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And then he switches a few pages over. Can't find it right away. And he says, this is what it looks like when we're living in the solution. This is what it looks like when we're connected. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone. I'm sorry, that's not it. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work with them, work for them. And then the person closes with this statement. You just heard a reading of what it looks like when you're living in the problem, and you just heard a reading of what it looks like when you're living in the solution, and now the choice is yours. We have a nice way of closing.
The group would like to thank Bill for sharing his experience with us tonight. The group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has a working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hands? Thank you. Please help us close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Thank you. Oh, sorry. We have someone who wants to come up to the mic.
That's all right. My name's Ed. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, during the meeting, thanks, Bill, and congratulations on your anniversary. That's awesome. And, you know, listening to Bill share his experience, strength, and hope, just about 3 years ago, I met the man who took me through the steps. And, you know, at 12 years without a drink, I decided to join the 12-step fellowship. And that doesn't mean I wasn't making meetings or anything. I was just coming and drinking your coffee and going to your AA functions and fellowshipping. I was one of those sick ones that thought it was a matter of putting down a drink, and that was it. And at 12 years without a drink, he remembers it differently than I, but, you know, the first day I met Paul and even Al, they were outside of the West Bethlehem group talking to me. And what I felt was dead inside. And I felt scared. I felt as though AA didn't work. And what my soon-to-be sponsor at that time saw was a clutched fist. And I was suffering from untreated alcoholism, and he pointed that out. And I was angry. I was depressed. I was losing everything material. But, again, that's the day that I joined the 12-step fellowship. And within 3 months, I had done my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. And I could stand up here for another hour and talk about how he has influenced my life. But I know how it works. So what I do is I take what he gave me and I carry it on to a new guy. And yesterday I was sitting in West Park in Allentown and sitting with a new guy. And one thing stood out to me out of that same chapter that Bill read out of. Living came before thinking. And what my sponsor taught me was to start doing the right action and the thinking will follow. And I had it backwards the whole time. My thinking won't get me sober all alone. My actions will help me change my thinking and stay sober. So I'd like to give my sponsor, Paul, his 6-year coin. He had 6 years on the 28th of May.
Thanks, everyone. My name is Paul Munch. I'm a recovered alcoholic. VI. That's six. I said in a meeting earlier in the week, it's much better than IV, because I was the type of alcoholic that was on the, I was going to die. And, you know, I came back after spending 2.5 years living the way Bill had first described, and I describe it as dry-briety. And I just didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I decided to pick up again, I did, and it got worse. And then when I decided that I needed to come back to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had seen and witnessed other people, which Bill described as the transformation, I knew that's what I needed to find. And when I did come back, this gentleman right here saw me, Rhubarb Jim. I saw Rhubarb at a meeting in Bethlehem, and he looked me square in the eye, and I could see him looking at me through the tears because I was in so much pain. And he just said something really simple. How long do you want to suffer, Paul? And I tried to say I don't want to suffer anymore, but I was crying too hard. And from that point forward, I made a commitment to myself and this program to live the way it's described right here. And my life has changed, you know. Had you known me 6 years ago, you would probably see a different Paul. I don't really want to judge it, but I know I think differently today. And my motto is love everybody. Doesn't mean I'm going to be loved back, but my motto is I need to love everybody the best of my ability. And I'll share one more thing that Ed always shares, and that is, see, I'm also not just an alcoholic, but I'm a drug addict too. And Dr. Bob has a prescription to the alcoholic, and I loved prescriptions when I was out there. And that is, trust God, clean house, help others. Thank you.